sound effect here, and I've got a column coming out on this. It's in press, actually, at the moment, and probably come out on Monday.
We have been talking with Dr. Kevin Trenberth, a leading specialist in oceans and the atmosphere. Kevin published hundreds of highly cited scientific papers, and he's still at it, now from New Zealand. It's hard to keep up with Kevin's work, but we try. Thank you so much for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Alex, and for all you do with Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Temporary extremes can leave big impacts. Call them hurricanes, typhoons, or tropical cyclones, as scientists do. They crash quickly through our lives, leaving a trail of damages. But we're just beginning to discover these big storms are a much bigger part of how the climate works. They change global energy and water. And this is a fundamental to understanding, I think, of how cyclones work on this planet. At Columbia University in New York, Susanna Camargo is a professor of climate, and she's at the Climate School. Educated in Brazil and Germany, Camargo is widely published and respected in her field. She continues to teach and mentor young scientists. Along with Kevin Trenberth, Camargo is a co-author of the new paper, Interactions of Tropical Cyclones with Global Energy and Water Cycles. From New York, Susanna Camargo, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
We think of tropical cyclones as short events, just a few days and then they're over. Introduce us to a couple of ways these big storms last longer in their impacts on the local region and the atmosphere.
We have always thought about tropical cyclones as a way in which the climate system of the Earth is able to transport energy from the tropics towards the mid-latitudes. That's why tropical cyclones exist, to help this transport, because we have, you know, most of the energy of the sun coming in the tropics, and that, you know, to balance the energy in the Earth, we have to transport that across the climate system, and there are various ways to do that, and the tropical cyclones is one way to do that. And now we have the ability to more measurements and theory and modeling to understand that better. So one way you can actually see that is, for instance, after you have a strong hurricane or typhoon passing through a certain region, you can clearly see through satellite pictures this wake of cold water that it's in the back after the typhoon or hurricane passes. And that cold water will stay there. These cold lakes, they can last for a while. They can then influence weather in the region. They can and have lots of effects that last longer time. So this is, you know, one way to think about it.
You talk about the cooling wake in the ocean, and that leads me to what I think is a common misunderstanding. We hear about that and we think, okay, tropical cyclones are a cooling mechanism on this warming planet, but that isn't really true, is it? They're just moving it somewhere else, the heat.
Exactly. So it's getting all this energy that's in the tropics where they form. As they move towards higher latitudes, they're taking all that energy with them. And that, you know, you can see the effect, for instance, you know, in various aspects of the climate, you know, in particular, you know, you look at the ocean circulation, you look at the atmosphere. We had something called, for instance, Rossby waves, which is like you can think about, like you see waves in the ocean, you can also have waves in the atmosphere. So when you have this hurricane happening, it basically helps generate this wave train. And this wave train, you're going to influence the weather far away from where this hurricane or this typhoon happened. So it's like multiple waves that the hurricanes and typhoons can influence the water cycle, influence, you know, radiation, and influence everything on Earth.
You're making it sound like the cyclones actually have a function on Earth, which is a bit like an overload system, so that so much energy builds up around the tropics that it has to release itself through these cyclones. Do we understand why there are cyclones on this planet, really?
Well, I think that's part of it. The cyclones exist to make this transport of energy. For instance, even when we have, you know, very simplistic, very old climate models, you know, in the 60s and 70s, which are based on the equations that physics equations that determine what's happening in the atmosphere and the ocean, you already have forming instantaneously in these climate models these features that look like tropical cyclones. Of course, they can't be, you know, at that resolution that we had of those climate models. They couldn't really simulate tropical cyclones, but they appear automatically when you try to simulate the climate of the Earth. Not only of the Earth, you can have features, you know, not with the, you know, with rotation and things like that in other planets as well. So that's part of the physics of the atmosphere. They appear. So it is, they are part of, you know, essential part of this transport. Not only tropical cyclones, for instance, we have, for instance, these northeasterns that happen now, that we had all this snow in the northeast of the U.S., they are also doing that. So winter storms can also help with this transport, having a big precipitation, convection systems, all that help with this transport of energy in the climate system.
Sometimes when I follow cyclones in the news, I'm surprised to find a track of them, like two or three. I saw two or three hit the Philippines in a relatively short period of time. Is there any indication that one big storm can lead to another?
So usually we have some conditions that help the formation there. We need for the formation of tropical cyclones. And some conditions in the atmosphere can lead to a cluster of a lot of storms for a short period and then be quiet for a while. So this is what we call subseasonal timescale. So within the hurricane season, we have periods that are very active and then periods that are less active. And we know some, you know, patterns of the atmosphere. One of them very well known, called the Madden-Julian Oscillation, that leads to this clustering of occurrence of hurricanes or typhoons. So basically, the Madden-Julian Oscillation is this big region that has a lot of convection and rainfall, and it starts usually in the Indian Ocean and moves towards the Atlantic. And wherever you have this region of very active, the Madden-Julian Oscillation, when the Madden-Julian is active, then you tend to have a lot of typhoons or hurricanes forming during that period. And that as it moves eastward, then it will be calm in that region and start being more active in that region that's now located. So this is a very well-known phenomena, and that's why, you know, people like me, we try to use that to see we can do forecasts at those shorter time scales, not the whole season, not the weather scales, but something in between. So can I say that, you know, the next 2 weeks are going to be very active or the next week is going to be very active? So we do have sometimes this clustering of activity, and we understand some of the causes that lead to them.
Right. For listeners used to hearing weather is not climate, how do you explain that a collection of extreme weather events like tropical cyclones could add up to a climate scale effect?
When we look at the climate impact, we're not looking at one specific storm. we look at the whole season in some basin like the Atlantic or the Western North Pacific, or we look, at the whole globe, how we do through a year, and then we look at that for many seasons, many years, and then we start to have an idea how this relationship with climate and tropical cyclones evolve. That happens part of natural variability. For instance, El Niño Southern Oscillation, which is a very well-known phenomenon, influence hurricane activity in the Atlantic, a typhoon activity in the Western Pacific. So when you have an El Niño event, which is this warmth in the tropical Pacific, typically then you tend to have an Atlantic season that's less active. So you have fewer hurricanes in the Atlantic. And that's because the El Niño event changed the patterns of the winds. And then how it changed the pattern of the winds leads to fewer hurricanes in the Atlantic. And the El Niño tends to last, typically, many months. So if you know that the El Niño event is happening, then you know that there's a higher probability of the Atlantic hurricane season being less active than normal. That's exactly what's happening right now. So right now, there's a forecast of an El Niño happening this 2026-2027. And if that actually happens, then the forecast for the next Atlantic hurricane season will be for less active than usual. So it doesn't mean that we are not going to have any Atlantic hurricanes, or there is no probability of a very intense hurricane that could lead to a lot of damage. But, that's all in terms of probabilities. Like you go to the casino, right? So basically you have your playing with your dice, and then, instead of having 1/6 probability in each side, El Niño is making some sides having higher probability than others. Doesn't mean that the side that has a lower probability is not going to happen, but there's a lower chance that that's going to happen. So we know that, tropical cyclones are affected by all these modes of climate variability. They're intrinsic of the climate system. That's natural variability. And that has been happening forever. So that's why it's important when we, there's a hurricane happening and people say, whoa, what's the role of climate change? We have been very careful how we ask that question, because, climate change doesn't cause a hurricane to happen. Hurricanes happen all the time, with or without climate change. What the question we can consider is, is climate change modifying the characteristics of this event, and if, how, about how much can we say? So this is this combination of the interaction of climate at various time scales, from the Madden-Julian oscillation that lasts a few months to, El Niño Southern Oscillation which lasts, almost a year, to, many, climate variability that lasts in decadal time scales, to then climate change that's a much longer time scale. So that's why it's complicated, because we have to be analyzing this interaction at all these time scales.
A friend of mine says we live in the climate casino, and everybody wants to know whether violent storms will get even stronger, or will they come more often as our emissions heat up the world. What do you think?
So, that's one of the things I have been studying for a long time, and I think the community has a very clear answer for many of the aspects of how climate change has influenced hurricanes and typhoons. Not all the aspects, but for instance, some of them are very clear. For instance, we are seeing more intense hurricanes and more intense typhoons happening with time. So we're having more of these Cat 4 and Cat 5 storms. So the proportion of them compared with what we used to have in the past is increasing. And we understand that. We have very good theory. We see in the observations, all the models do that very well. Then we also know that because in a warmer world, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. So we know that it's possible to have more of these extreme precipitation events, not only hurricanes, other any kind of extreme precipitation events. So similarly to other extreme precipitation events, we can have, you know, more mean rainfall and also the more extreme rainfall associated with the, in a warmer climate. Another very clear aspect is related to sea level rise. So if we have sea level rise, even if we had exactly the same hurricane, if we had storm surge, that would lead to a higher level of flooding because, you know, you have the flooding that would be expected, that you'd be associated with that storm, but then you have put a certain amount of sea level rise on top of that. So these are factors that are very well known. In terms of numbers, that's one of the aspects that is very active in terms of research. You know, the most models project having fewer hurricanes and typhoons in the future globally, not by in the specific region that the uncertainty is too big, but in some different types of modeling and can lead to actually more storms. So that's, and we are trying to understand why is it that are these differences, can we then narrow down if we're going to have more or fewer? But even if you have slightly, you know, let's say we have a decrease of 10% of the number of tropical cyclones globally, you still have so many, and you still could, and some of those could be these very destructive ones. So we see when we just have a couple of them that make landfall and they're very strong or meet and core cause a lot of flooding, then, you know, this destruction is very big and can lead to a lot of socioeconomic impact. So this counting is on some lands is not so important. Is, you know, if we are having these storms that are more intense in terms of winds, they're bringing more rainfall, leading a lot of flooding. That's very important. We cannot forget, though, that we are making ourselves more vulnerable for these events as well. So it's not only what's happening in terms of climate. If you, you know, put more people, more infrastructure in locations that have a high chance of being affected by hurricane or typhoons, we are increasing the chance of having these big disasters. So it's not only what climate change is doing, but also what we are doing in terms of what we call exposure and vulnerability. So you can imagine, you know, the Great Miami Hurricane that happened in the early 20th century happening exactly now, exactly the same storm. So no climate change story there. Just because we have, you know, Miami has increased multiple times, and the number of people, all the buildings, all the bridges, roads, everything. So the impact, the socioeconomic impact, would be multiple times bigger, and that's part of the story too. So when we are analyzing the impact of these storms in terms of socioeconomic impact, this is part of the story as well. We cannot blame everything on climate change.
No, that's true with fires too, wildfires. People are moving into forested areas, and then, of course, you get more damage and more homes burned because they're right there in the fire zone.
Exactly.
When I'm looking at different aspects of climate, I'm always having an eye out for feedbacks. I'm wondering if there could be any here. I mean, could changes in cyclone statistics under global warming, if they do happen, could those feedback into the climate system itself? Did you find any signs of feedbacks in your reviews?
I think that's a little hard to do at this point. I think we have, could be. But, you know, I think these signals are still, I think, hard to see for multiple reasons. You know, I think we need better data for tropical cyclones globally, both in the atmosphere and in the ocean. You know, just in a few basins, we fly into hurricanes, and these are is the best data that the best data that we can gather is when we fly into hurricanes and we gather data inside the storm. And then in the ocean, we just have very spotty data. So if we, for instance, if we're going to see feedbacks, the ocean has to be clearly part of the story. And I don't think we have enough data for that. And also, you know, we have about 80 storms per year, and they are, you know, in specific locations every year. So for us to start to see these feedbacks, we have, you know, really to, I think, we improve both our data quality, data amount of data, and also improve our understanding in terms of modeling and all this process. So I think that we are doing progress in those in terms of looking at these feedbacks, but I think we still have a lot to understand.
Susanna, are there misconceptions in policy or in media talk about hurricanes and climate that you wish that your work could help correct?
Well, I think I don't like exaggerating the role of climate change, like discounting the role that we are doing by building houses in the path of hurricanes and things like that. But also we cannot ignore them. We have to be careful when we are thinking in terms of policy, considering both what we're doing in terms of climate change, but also what we're doing in terms of development, in terms of our policy to where people should live, and insurance and things like that. Think that we have to be careful when we do policy, because these are things that are intrinsically linked. They are not separate. And as I said, you know, there is a role for climate change, but I do not like also to try to exaggerate that, to try for to make politicians listen to us. We have to be careful. We don't want to be the boy calling wolf and exaggerate the impacts and exaggerate what we know and what we don't know.
I hear you, but I think we have the opposite problem, that nobody's crying wolf when we do have a developing climate emergency, not just with hurricanes, but with all sorts of things. I mean, look at the weather in the West right now. It's summer in winter when you get to the Western United States. Well, look, as we wrap this up, what are you and your colleagues working on next? Where can listeners find out more?
What are we working on? We are working a lot with tropical cyclone risk and try to understand this combination of climate change and try to put together the socioeconomic impacts, try to look at combined impacts of wind risk and flooding risk. So all these things that we're trying to work together, we are working together with the private industry because they're very worried about that. Reinsurance companies, for instance, they really worried about these issues. So it's a combination of understanding the physics of climate cyclones. At the same time, we put together models that can look in more detail the impacts into infrastructure and social economy, things like that.
From Columbia University, we've been speaking with Dr. Susanna Camargo. Susanna is co-author of a major new review of tropical cyclones called Interactions of Tropical Cyclones with Global Energy and Water Cycles. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Susanna, thank you for your insights and for talking with us.
Very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If we really crank it up, are we really confident we're topping at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or, you know, it's you can think of a burn-it-all future getting really hot.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Isn't it strange to see the staid International Energy Agency publishing tips on how to save money during the Middle East oil and gas crash? Use public transit, work from home, fly less. You think? We've been saying that for years. Two quick things as we wrap up. This energy squeeze is not temporary. Some production infrastructure wrecked in the Gulf War will take up to 5 years to repair, according to the government in Qatar. Shipping will take a long time to rebalance. More people and countries will turn to cheap renewables. Plus, a crash of consumer demand and an economic depression could cripple the consumer's ability to go back to those fossil-burning days. Second thing, it's just not enough. The proposals to cope with the Middle East shutdown are tiny band-aids, nowhere near enough. When we get summer and winter, violent storms, drought threatening millions, a long list of damages, then we know this really is a climate emergency. I assume gas prices in America could reach European levels, so maybe $8 to $10 a gallon. Already news reports show airport security workers not showing up because they can't afford the gas to the airport. America built affordable living hours away from workplaces with no walkable shops, giant gas-guzzling cars as the solution. Where people must drive to live, and only the rich can afford the gas, then it is time for gas rationing. We don't need cards in a digital age. Some people get gas rations that don't need them so they can sell them to others, that's fine, but overall use and emissions are capped, and the cap gets lowered every year. This is wartime, but not with each other. We need wartime emergency action to save a livable climate now for our kids, for our descendants. Ban private flights, invest in mass transit and divest from fossil fuels, return national bus service, rebuild railways, buy less, use less. That is where every country needs to be, starting yesterday. There is no time left to keep killing each other. No time left for blowing up cities or fighting for male dominance over and over. The only winners are climate survivors. We are the ones to become those survivors. The living world you save may be your own. That's how I see it. Thank you for listening when many won't. Keep caring for each other, won't you?
Loaned on the cheap, never know, never wake up to the heat. Hurry, hurry, nothing we can.
listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.